Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, of course, and the sharp-eared among you, you've probably been able to tell from the sound of the room we're in that we're not in our normal spot. I'm not in my office, and you're not in your man cave, your Sten gun-lined man cave in Wiltshire.
It's a slightly different ambience here.
So, Jim, where are we? What are we doing? Who are we here to see?
Well, we're here at one of the finest places in the UK, particularly if you're a historian. It is the National Archives. For those who are a bit longer in the tooth, we'll remember
Public Record Office, the PRO.
But the acronym for it now, if you're doing your footnotes at the end of the book, is now TNA. So it's the National Archives with a T, capital T.
Wonderful.
Anyway, we're joined by Dr. Will Butler, and you're the head of modern documents, specialising in military.
When does modern start, Will?
When does modern start? Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh no, thanks for having us, because we've come to see you, more importantly. Yes. It's very much that way round. When does modern begin?
1782, with the creation of the Foreign Office and the Home Office.
Well, I would have gone 1968, you know, from when I was born, you know.
That's modern.
Could have pinned it to something
Everybody
concrete.
Else is history.
There is no universe, there's a meaniverse, basically.
I mean, it's lovely being here. I remember so well the first time I ever came here. It was when I was doing work on the Malta book. And the first document I looked at was the logbook for HMS Upholder, the submarine, British submarine, yeah, operating out of Malta. Wanklyn and Co. And I remember back in the day, you couldn't photograph anything and you had to annotate everything with a pencil. And it took me literally a week just to do that. And now you turn up, I've just ordered up 4 documents this morning.
You take a picture on your phone?
Take a picture on your phone, job done, half an hour, bish, bash,
bosh. Amazing. Bosh, well, I first came here in 1984.
Oh yes, on your project.
My history project for my O-level, where I inevitably, and the regular listener will stare into the middle distance now, about the Battle of Arnhem, and I pulled out the battle diaries.
And so it begins.
And read the battle diaries that, of course, were in all the books, but actually to hold the thing and see the thing and watch the, you know, watch the drama play out. Although some of those diaries were written up afterwards, but that's not the point. You've got the item, you know, in your hand. It's incredible.
Yeah, and the war diaries, they're one of my favourite collections that we have, are the Second World War war diaries. The kinds of material that you can find in there that you weren't anticipating. It's incredible what finds its way in those diaries beyond the kind of day-to-day diary entries, the operational side of things. But yeah, I'm never bored, put it that way. It's always exciting.
So how does one become, you know, head curator, modern military? Are you a historian by trade or an archivist by trade?
I'm a historian by trade. So, and I think the short answer is by accident, how I end up here. But I'm certainly a historian by trade, not an archivist. We've got some fantastic archivists here, fantastic colleagues who specialise much more in that kind of area. But I'm very much a historian of the 19th and 20th century British Army in particular. And went to university, did my PhD, worked as a university lecturer for a while. And my PhD was on the amateur military tradition in Ireland. So I was very interested in things like the militia in the 19th century, the the Imperial Yeomanry during the South African War, Volunteer Training Corps, Home Guard, all the way up to the Second World War. So that was kind of my focus, and Ireland being the backdrop, if you like, to a lot of that. And then I worked as a university lecturer for a little while, and then found my way here doing lots of the public-facing things, which are, you know, just incredibly exciting to be able to communicate my love of history, the, you know, the records that we have here, to massive audiences. And it's such a privilege to be able to do that.
Well, there is something very exciting about touching original documents, I think. You know, it's there's the pen, that, you know, the ink that was signed, used signature of Churchill or whatever it might be. You know, it's there's that real tactile link to the past, isn't it? And that's brilliant.
So before we get into what we're here to talk about in particular, how does it work here? To the uninitiated, what do you do? I mean, we're in Kew, so we're south of the river. You get the train to Kew, or you the tube to Kew Gardens, and you walk, or you and there's a, you could drive in, there's a car park, but then what?
And then there's this amazing building with a lake, and it looks like a kind of sort of modern university.
Yes, it feels
campus.
Very like you're on a campus here.
Yeah. Fortress almost. Well, yes. Yeah.
So then you, what do? You register? Because I remember when I came here, you know, in the 80s, I had to have a letter from my headmaster as a reference, and we had to wait for that to have happened. And then I turned up with my letter, and I remember thinking, you know, I'm being allowed into somewhere sort of secret, super special. They're kind of like, oh, right, okay, in you come.
Presumably that was at Somerset House, wasn't it?
No, it was here.
Was it
I
here?
Came to Kew, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, the building opened in the 1970s, so it has been here a little while.
Yeah, I came here by train on a Sunday or something, and spent the, and I remember my history teacher thinking, he's taking this a bit too seriously. This
is just it's only an O level.
Get a grip, buddy. But you've
got the bug, haven't you?
I've completely been bitten by it. But Will, so tell us how it works. What if someone says to themselves, I want to go to the National Archive, I want to pull something out. Where do you because obviously you're modern, but there's before modern, which is called what?
We have medieval and early modern teams as well. Our earliest document is dates to the 11th century. So
right.
That gives you a bit of an idea.
Okay, anyway. Great. So from there, if you want to come here and pull something out of the archive, how do you do that? And what's the scope as well? So where's the edge?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the key is that anybody can turn up to the building if they've got two forms of ID with them. They can come from anywhere in the world and come to a computer terminal and order their documents on this side of things. And then there's a reading room on the other side from where we're sitting this afternoon, and their documents will be waiting for them in a pigeonhole, ready for them to read.
And in fact, my documents will be ready for me in, about an hour's time.
Incredible.
Yeah, so just waiting for me in 41B.
But you're well used to coming here.
It is an amazing place, and it's amazing how often you see the same people here as well.
Right.
Quite a lot of sort of blokes of a certain age with...
Regulars.
Yeah. Sort of retired gents.
What's pulled out? Which period is the busiest? What, you know, on what type of document are people looking at the most?
So this isn't me just saying it, but our military records are some of the most popular records that we hold. A lot of them obviously are digitized. You know, if you're interested in the First World War, a lot of those war diaries are digitized, the surviving service records are digitized, but we also have an awful lot of military records that aren't, and they tend to be some of our most popular record series. So I already mentioned the Second World War war diaries. They're certainly one of our most popular sets of records, as are muster rolls and pay lists from the 19th century British Army as well as things like officer service records from the First World War as well. So like I say, I'm not just saying it. From a military point of view, and our military teams are some of our busiest, for sure, in terms of the interest.
But then given conscription, a vast chunk of the population passes through, literally passes through government, as it were, or through the government, if you want to look at it like that. So it's a great way, if you're looking for your ancestors, to echolocate someone is via the military, because the chances are, so in one way or another, they've been caught up in it by you know, not one world war but two. You know, there's two generations of people who you can place through these records, right?
Absolutely. And you know, those records, and also the census records, which we also hold. So you know, again, for family historians, those interested in kind of tracing the history of their ancestors in that way, absolutely the way to do that for a lot of people beyond the census or electoral rolls are service in the military, ultimately.
But for those who want to research their families in the Second World War, personnel files haven't been released into the public domain yet. So
they are starting to.
They're starting to, which is an exciting moment. But up and, you know, until they all are, you've still got to go and apply for them through the Ministry of Defence. And there's a if you just Google
that's more difficult
Ministry of Defence personnel records or military records or whatever, it will just immediately come up with a link, and you have to sort of apply for it and pay so 20 quid or whatever it is.
The records are on their way here to TNA, exciting. And the first batch of those will be digitised towards the end of next year. So do watch out for that.
So how many records are there here, though? How big is it? And if, say, you just said you're about to receive another batch, how does that work?
We always need space for records in the repository, and that surprises people, I think, sometimes. You know, we are the official UK government archives. Obviously, increasingly, we get records that are born digital, if you like, from government, but we still receive the majority of our records are physical records, paper. They're pieces of paper, they're folders. You know, amazing. Our catalogue contains 11 million records in the entry, but it's a lot bigger than that. And as I say, you know, there are certain transfers, you know, the service records in particular, which are massively increasing the amount of material that we have.
I mean, are there satellite sites for, you know, storage and stuff? Or?
So we do have an off-site storage facility in an old salt mine in Cheshire. So that's where that is.
You never knew.
That's brilliant.
Is that because the salt sucks out the moisture?
Just don't park your car there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's got a scratch.
Yeah, just go back to your point about the war diaries, and this is the unit war diaries. You're so right about the sort of hidden gems you find in those, because quite often they're written up and it's a landscape, not portrait form. So you get this sort of, you know, full scat page. Sometimes they're handwritten, sometimes they're typed up. But what you get is quite often you get little sort of extra bits at the end. And I remember when I was doing all that research on Hedley Verity, the cricketer, the breakthrough for me was included in the war diary was a hand sketch of the dispositions of the first Green Howards on the Catania plain. And you could match the hand sketch with Google Earth. And that's what enabled me to kind of pinpoint where he'd been. And had it not been for that hand sketch being half decent and decent enough to be able to match it up with Google Earth, you'd never know.
Gosh. Well, there you go. Right. So what are we here to talk about? A new exhibition that's
opens at the end of January, doesn't it?
2nd of February.
2nd of February.
That's the day my tour starts.
Ooh.
So thank God I've got a sneak preview.
Yeah, exactly.
Jump the queue. And it's called Great Escapes, and it's about the experience of prisoners of war.
And civilian internees as well.
And civilian internees. So the interned, as it were, in the Second World War, and in Europe, and in the Far East, and also here.
Yes, because Germans and Italians,
and then aliens, as they were called. Where do you begin with a subject like that? Because it's enormous. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people.
It is enormous. The easier option would have been to choose either prisoners of war or civilian internees as our focal point, but we decided to work on both. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting things about the records that we have at TNA is you might often assume that they're top down, if you see what I mean. They're government level documents. So you'll never get that kind of personal touch. But actually, what our records show, and if you look closely enough, beyond, you know, service records, beyond prisoner of war records, is we have a lot of personal records, personal accounts of individuals' experiences during this period. We decided and kind of landed on the name Great Escapes. Obviously, it's a play to some extent on The Great Escape, and the exhibition does conveniently coincide with the 80th anniversary of the Great Escape from Stalaglyph 3. But that isn't the focus. What we were really interested in is telling the story of those physical escapes, of course. You know, those stories that perhaps people are a little more familiar with when it comes to that, certainly prisoner of war experience. But what we actually wanted to do is look at the variety of ways that people sought to escape the kind of reality of their captivity, both from a military personnel and civilian personnel. So I suppose, broadly speaking, the mental escapes, the activities that are going on within camps, what people are actually doing to deal with their day-to-day reality, really.
Well, there's a very nice feature in the exhibition of a guy from, I think he's from Jamaica, who's taken prisoner in France in 1940. He's saying, I've decided to become a clairvoyant so that I can still communicate with you all.
I can telephone you whenever I want.
Absolutely. Really funny.
Absolutely. And, you know, so that's just one snippet. You know, in his letters, he talks about he studied for a law degree. He completed a law degree whilst a prisoner of war.
Well, why not?
You might as well. So it's you know, you have those yeah, those really interesting things.
Stalags are sort of universities, aren't they, in a sense.
But also, like all these things in the Second World War, I mean, nothing's a straight line. And the experience that you have, you know, being a German, a prisoner of the Germans, for example, in 1940, you know, where food is comparatively plentiful and, you know, nothing too awful's happened and it's
conditions of peace
and yeah, and they're winning, you know, they can afford to be a little bit magnanimous. It's sort of okay, but by, you know, second half of 1943, it's absolutely horrendous because, of course, Germany's starving and prisoners of war are kind of quite low down on the kind of priority list. So people are getting very hungry, conditions bad, disease comes with bad conditions. And then, of course, you've got these awful marches, particularly from the camps that are being escaping the advancing Russians back end of 1944, beginning of 1945, you know, across this sort of bleak winter Eastern Europe landscape. I mean, really, really tough. And it could be absolutely brutal.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can trace that story through our collections here at TNA. You know, ultimately, you know, one of the things that's obviously happening are, you know, things like Red Cross inspections of a lot of these camps, both in the UK, but also in Europe, and to a much lesser extent in East Asia as well, and trace exactly those kinds of problems and issues, you know, the fairly or decent enough accommodation and food, medical attention, et cetera, early on in the war for Allied prisoners of war in particular. But then, you know, by 1944, early 45, as you say, tracing some of that much more kind of challenging situation that prisoners find themselves in. You know, you have accounts whereby, you know, individuals are playing sport a lot in 1941, 42. Right. And then, you know, you literally have these reports that are saying by the end of 43 into 44 and 45, you know, this kind of activity doesn't happen in the same way as it used to, and primarily because food is scarce and people just don't have the physical capacity to play football every day or
at the weekend. Like a BK, like Sylvester Stallone in goal.
Yeah, exactly. No, just.
But also, I mean, but it's not a straight line in Southeast Asia either, is it? And you know, when you're a prisoner of the Japanese, you know, my understanding is that there was no kind of code within the Japanese that said you've got to kind of treat all prisoners absolutely brutally. It was sort of culturally inferred, but obviously different camp commanders were
behaved differently.
There wasn't a sort of rule book. There wasn't a sort of consistency of it. So you could get away with it. I mean, I remember interviewing some people who were prisoners. I think they ended up being prisoners on a Japanese home island somewhere. Maybe they were even on Japan itself. The nightmare for them had been the crossing in the boat.
Yeah,
you know, that had been the absolute worst thing, and they'd had some. You know, it wasn't a picnic by any stretch of the imagination once they were in the camp, but it certainly wasn't kind of, you know, Thai Burma Railway kind of conditions.
Yeah, absolutely, and quite often, yeah, exactly. The most lethal part was the journey, as you say. You know, probably most famously, the Lisbon Maru is the kind of Allied hell ship as they were known, which was sunk by an Allied submarine, I think. So, you know, killed a quite high number of Allied prisoners of war. And that was on a journey to mainland Japan, to a camp in Japan from Hong Kong. So, you know, often that was the most perilous part of the experience.
Right. Well, should we take a break and then look at some documents?
Yeah.
Should we do that?
Good plan.
Yeah, okay, we'll be back in a second.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk here at TNA, the National Archive. And Will, we've talked about this, let's actually look at some of what you got, stuff you've got here for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we've got in front of us here are some records specifically to do with prisoners of war and to a lesser extent civilian internees in Southeast Asia. And what they do to some extent is build up a picture about what the British government in particular is trying to do during the war around ensuring they know exactly what's going on when it comes to prisoners of war. But what they're having to do is piece together information in a much more piecemeal way than, for example, in Europe. You know, Japan doesn't follow the Geneva Convention in the same way as nations do, as Germany and Britain, for example.
Is it a signatory to it, though?
It never ratified it.
Right.
So it doesn't. So there are some elements whereby it does. Japan does follow certain parts of the convention. So it allows some Red Cross inspections, for example. And we actually have some photographs here on the table taken during some of those inspections. But Allied governments are still really having to piece together that information. They're not getting the consistent reports back. They're not getting consistent information from individuals within camps. You know, ultimately, most individuals can't send or receive much in the way of post and letters. So they really are relying on lots of different places in order to try and piece together that information, and then, you know, ultimately then trying to communicate that to those who have relatives who are in captivity.
And are they worried about too much bad news? Because if you're dealing with the families, do you want to say to them they're being held in hellish conditions and may not survive? I mean, there's surely that consideration as a government to make, isn't there?
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's certainly an element to that. One of the pieces of correspondence we have in front of us here talks about the British government almost, but not quite being in denial, but not recognising the severity of the situation.
Yes.
Whether that's the case or whether it's actually being pragmatic in that approach is perhaps, you know, the way to think about it.
So this is an extract from the New Statesman and Nation, a weekend review dated August the 12th, 1944, headed Prisoners of Japan. And who wrote this?
So this is so a few individuals.
Hunt, J.W. Burnford, W.B. Bennett. And it says, "Sir, may we draw your attention to some little known facts about the terrible situation of some 300,000 European internees in prisons in Japanese prison camps. The worst camps are situated in three districts, Hong Kong, the Malayan Jungle and Thailand. Therefore, generalizations about camp conditions based on those in Peiping, most other parts of China, Shanghai and Japan itself cannot be applicable to them." So they're basically saying, we found out, we know what's going on, and the government isn't across it properly.
And just below here it says, "There seems to be a lamentable state of wishful thinking about the real conditions on the part of our government." Yeah. So again, kind of furthering that point.
Yeah, the complacent statements that are made from time to time are used by the Japanese as propaganda, possibly also as a reason for denying neutral inspectors access to the southern camps and for minimising the urgency of parcel deliveries. Right. So how do these guys know, though? I mean, that's the interesting thing. Are they being authorised? Sometimes government does that thing where it gets someone to write a column, doesn't it? So they can fly a kite and they can see what the response is like. Because one of the interesting things about the Second World War is that a lot of politics is conducted in the usual manner. Even though you have a national government, they're still doing. There's still opinion pieces in the newspapers. The newspapers will disagree with government policy and all that sort of stuff, in a way that I don't know that people necessarily have an appreciation of that. They think, oh, it's the war, so everyone behaves themselves in the way they express opinion and the way politics is operated. That's just not the case, is it?
No, absolutely not. Especially on some of these kinds of issues, and again, what, you know, quite often in these sets of files that are obviously created by the British government, or indeed compiled by the British government, is you get a piece of correspondence that will say, you know, this letter is from so-and-so who has a relative who knows someone who is in this camp, and they've managed to get this piece of information out, and this is what they're saying about the situation and about what's happening. And that's what the government is trying to do mainly just to try and find out. You know, there's a lot of intelligence that's also happening from a military point of view, you know, as you might expect. Military intelligence.
But generally speaking, Will, I mean, how much do people back in the UK know of the conditions for prisoners of the Japanese?
Not very well, I think.
That's amazing. So at the end of the war, it is genuinely a surprise to find all these sort of skeletons coming out. sort of emaciated people.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, even not being fully aware of the situation in Europe as well, right. Particularly towards the end
so
of
it's
the
not
war,
just Japan.
As it's worsening, you know, that's kind of, as you say, the general rule being that, you know, the war is not going the way of Germany and Japan. And so the conditions for prisoners of war and internees is
inevitably going to be bad. I mean, this is amazing, isn't it? Because this is a document of presumably a POW camp hospital.
It is exactly that, yes.
And I'm just looking at this guy, Albert J. Shadwell of Lynch Overton, Basingstoke, Hants. So they very carefully put in the where they're from. There's another guy from Number 8 Strawberry Bank, Alfwaite, Nottinghamshire. But Albert Shadwell, crikey. So he's got beriberi fever, malaria, septic sores, and, check this, scrotal dermatitis. I mean, just one of those sounds pretty bad, to be honest, but all four,
isn't a bad way. The medicine on offer isn't brilliant either, so.
Absolutely not.
Antibiotics and.
And again, what you get an awful lot of improvisation. So we've got, again, quite a large number of records of the medical treatment that is happening and taking place for prisoners of war. So there are doctors, there are medical personnel who are improvising artificial appliances for those who've had to have an amputation, for example. They are distilling alcohols, literally creating medicines from their raw ingredients to some degree as well, in order to, you know, supplement the very limited amount of medical equipment and care that they're receiving from their captors. And those four.
This is just absolutely horrendous. I'm just looking at it now. I mean, you know, anemia, diarrhea, dermatitis. Quite a lot of people seem to have scrotal dermatitis. Quite a lot of people have septic sores, tropical ulcers, dengue, jaundice, ulcers, scrotal dermatitis on another chap, diarrhea, malaria, beriberi, beriberi, diarrhea, bronchitis, gastritis, dysentery, malaria. That's just one guy. No, one guy's got appendicostomy, enteritis, bronchitis, gastritis, dysentery, and malaria. I mean, flipping heck. This guy down here, Donald Smith of Claremont Street, Wycliffe, in Yorkshire, he dies on the 5th of September 1944 at 10:30. Chronic emphysema, bronchopleural, I can't see that, and just exhaustion. So he's just...
He's done.
Series of people, it just conjures up a kind of image of lots of people just suffering horrifically, and you just imagine what the stench must have been like, the kind of inability to keep basic hygiene, but everyone kind of...
Well, and people not being strong enough to fight infections because they're malnourished. Isn't
of course.
That's absolutely. What that's saying.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. It's about the limited diet, the lack of clean water, and then when becoming ill, the lack of adequate medical attention.
So there's another guy, John A. Streets of 104 Adelaide Broad, East Cowes, Isle of Wight. He dies on the 14th of August 1944 of amoebic dysentery and beriberi fever. I mean, no one's got a single thing. I mean, it's all... I mean, what is amazing is how many people do seem to survive. I mean, the number of deaths is comparatively
like,
small.
It looks like everyone went to the doctor, though.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And this is just one of many volumes of these kinds of hospital admissions that we have.
There's a Murray. Look up the Murray.
Yeah,
that's what I always do.
Look at the Murray. Colin, WA. He lived in down in Kent.
Right.
Tropical ulcers, malaria, chronic malaria, and beriberi. Okay, let's see if there's any Hollands.
Isn't that a Holland?
Yeah, Holland. Albert A. L. Holland. Doesn't say what he was.
It just says
Let's
gone.
Look at McCarthy.
It just says gone.
Gone. He's gone.
But I mean, these are being kept by the medical personnel who are in the camps. And are these then used as evidence, as presented to the War Office and said, look at the situation we found ourselves
in? Oh, my God. This guy's got malaria, diarrhea, typhus, tropical ulcers, beriberi, and scrotal dermatitis. How on earth did he survive? That's astonishing. I mean, crikey. It's a sort of catalogue of human misery, isn't it?
It is. And absolutely, that's exactly what these records are used for, is in that post-war kind of investigations of war crimes, ultimately. Yeah. So, you know, what they're doing, what the authorities are doing when it comes to these investigations are then starting to interview individuals who will talk about, you know, there are post-liberation questionnaires for prisoners of war that are taken both in Europe and in Southeast Asia, whereby prisoners are specifically asked, did you witness any mistreatment of prisoners of war? You know, and you might imagine some people spend a lot of time writing quite a lot of detail, and then there would be follow-up then by military intelligence to investigate that.
But also, let's not, you know, kid ourselves. I mean, the Japanese troops themselves aren't immune from all this stuff. I mean, and also by kind of 1943-44, where, you know, it's only 88% of their GDP on defence. There's not an awful lot of room left for medicine.
No, absolutely not.
And it's the nature of that part of the world, is you know, the climate and the humidity and the and you're living outdoors. It's going to get you.
Yes, absolutely.
Now let's move along. What are these here? These photographs here.
So people with beards.
They do have beards. Yeah. So we have a real collection here of photographs taken. So there's two batches of photographs, if you like. The top batch here are some post-liberation photographs of individuals, and again, they give you an idea of the kind of state that a lot of these guys
are in. Well, he's got a size 24 waist, hasn't he?
Yes. You know, and you get a bit of an idea about their diet. And then the second batch of photographs are those propaganda images that letter that we mentioned a moment ago were talking about, that, you know, they're photographs of Red Cross inspections, and there are photographs of prisoners exercising and tending to allotments and, you know, generally looking like they're having not too bad a time. It's a holiday camp, basically. You know, and that's what is being released to authorities.
I suppose in that theatre, that what you haven't got, you've got very, very few Japanese combatants who are prisoners, because they tend not to, very, very, very few, literal handfuls of people. Mm-hmm. So you can't do a kind of reciprocal propaganda thing.
Oh, gosh, sorry, I've just seen this.
Oh, go on then.
Okay, so you got a picture of, they've basically all got bare feet. One of them's just wearing nothing but a loincloth. He's got one leg missing, and it says, Major McCurd, Indian Medical Services from Ontario, Canada, was captured by the Japs, became hospital surgeon in the prison camp, with one of his patients, Corporal J. Usher from Wrexham, North Wales, whose leg was successfully amputated, although Major McCurd was not permitted any anaesthetic supply for the job. And needs to say, they're skin and bones. Wow.
And as you know, and these aren't all necessarily combat injuries as well that are resulting in amputations. They're, you know, the work that they're being forced to do is incredibly dangerous. And so there's a kind of, a constant flow of those kinds of injuries that surviving medical personnel are having to deal
with.
Yes,
because you get a graze, it goes septic, you get gangrene, leg comes off.
Absolutely.
And what's amazing is how they all, you know, they're sort of squatting down, aren't they? They're used to not sitting on chairs. They're all on their haunches.
And as I say, you can see the kind of condition that they're in by the end here. So again, you know, what the British government then is doing upon liberation, if you like, and when then prisoners are making their long journey back to the UK, is they're providing an awful lot of information about diet and what prisoners should and shouldn't eat and drink. And because, again, you know, they've been so malnourished for a long time. And again, this is also the case in Europe by the end of the war, that, you know, there is a what to do and what not to do with diets. You know, these official publications that every prisoner is given that says you should not, you know, drink too much beer, you should not eat this, don't have rich food, don't have sweet food. It's kind of that very, very basic diet. And then it's also providing material for relatives as well to help prisoners and support prisoners settle back into civil society as well. And that was probably something that surprised me, I think, when looking at our records, the kind of work that is carried out by the Allied authorities around resettlement and ensuring, you know, recognising the psychological impact of...
You know, we're talking at least 500,000, if you include the people from the British soldiers in Europe and then in the Far East, it's 500,000 people, basically, who then come back into... leave the military as well, come back into civil society, who've been incarcerated. And I've just, how does that express itself in 50s and 60s and 70s culture? Mm-hmm. You know, if only in attitudes to prison, you know, because people who've been incarcerated have a different view on it necessarily, don't they? Or have, so I'm wondering what the social sort of bow wave of this might be, as much as anything else. And I don't wonder if anyone's written about that. Well, maybe someone who's listening knows, and we'll,
yeah, I'm sure,
dig something up. And these are these propaganda pictures you're talking about. So there's chaps doing exercise and then sewing and generally having a sort of constructive, oh look, they're fishing, those officers, they're having a good time. But both sides do this, don't they? They're entirely sort of standard routine propaganda, isn't it?
Absolutely. And yeah, so this is a photograph of an inspection with a Red Cross inspector here.
Who must know perfectly what's going on.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, and you see they're all stamped by the Red Cross,
by the Red
as well,
Cross.
These photographs.
Who occupy this interesting space where they can only really go where they're allowed to go. And are used as a seal of approval and are being exploited. I think that's part of the sort of the mosaic, isn't it? Gosh, these are incredible, though.
What we can do if we wanted to move over to the Europe table, I'm quite taken by this as well.
A handbook for the information of relatives and friends of prisoners of war and civilians in Japanese or Japanese-occupied territory. You've still got to pay 2 pence for it, though. It's not terribly helpful, but it does dispel one myth, which is that while interned merchant seamen are credited with the sums they would otherwise have continued to receive as wages, less the amount that would have been deducted for income tax. As long as they're still paying tax, that's important. but there's that myth, isn't there, that once you're a merchant seaman, once you kind of, you know, you're parted from your ship, the pay stops. But obviously that's not the case. But even so, I mean, it's not exactly saying, I mean, I imagine this was going to say, you know, when your relative comes back, you might find him a little bit changed and, you know, be patient with him. None of that.
And there are other handbooks that do that to some extent, I must say. And then there are other kind of more practical things. So you find publications which talk about how you address a letter to your prisoner of war, what information is required, what format it needs to go in. So there is some kind of practical element to
you do hear stories about people coming back and insisting on sleeping on the floor and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
can't cope with the bed anymore. Which again speaks to profound psychological effect and I mean damage, that's the right word even, but like the footprint of this experience is really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And like I say, what surprised me is actually how much thought the authorities are putting into that psychological. Whether they had a solution for that is another question, but they are thinking about those
kinds
of things.
But I think that comes across, we've been talking about combat fatigue a lot, or battle fatigue, or whatever name you want to call it, because after all, the name keeps changing and the diagnosis changes with it, and then the people who are diagnosed tend to keep up with the diagnosis as well. It exhibits itself in that way. Actually, a lot of the ideas in the 40s seem strikingly modern, whereas we'd think, oh, it's 80 years ago. What do they know? They don't know anything like we do about psychology and psychiatry. And actually, there's a lot of really neat, what we'd see as progressive thinking going on, things being tried out that don't feel like they're from the middle of the last century at all. They feel quite contemporary. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly bears out in the paperwork.
Yeah.
Well, for sure.
Anyone knows about the paperwork.
That's me. I'll keep going on about the paperwork all the time. So we've moved on to these are images from prisoner of war camps in Central Europe, essentially. And hopefully gives us an idea about kind of thinking about the comparisons between those experiences. So, you know, we saw a moment ago those Red Cross photographs about inspections. Mm. We have whole volumes of Red Cross inspections for individual camps, you know, in our collection here. There's hundreds and hundreds of pages. The one we have here, for example, is our inspection reports from Stalag 8B, Lambsdorff, the kind of one of the more, well, certainly one of the bigger camps. We have photograph albums, they're postcards actually.
Stalag 1.
I mean, look at this funeral. Funeral of Sergeant J.C. Shaw, Stalag 1. He's on a carriage.
There's horses.
There's horses. There's a man in a top hat, you know. There's mourners and everything. I mean, if you didn't know that was happening in Germany, you'd never know, right? You'd just assume that was in Britain.
There's a picture of Sergeant J.C. Shaw in his casket.
Next to another photograph of people playing ice hockey.
Yes, of course, yes. And then, well, I mean, that's not how he met his end.
No. Yeah.
And then German honour guard. I mean, it's extraordinary. And that's...
Girls, 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 review show.
Yep. Many pictures of girls, girls, girls.
Yeah, the mini theatre, the sheer number of theatre productions is quite incredible.
The Merchant of Venice.
Yeah, and the elaborate costumes that a lot of these photographs, you know, and again, it's perhaps an element you don't think about when it comes to the prisoner of war experience. You know, these costumes are being made within the camps by prisoners.
Well, Merchant of Venice is Stalaglyph 3.
Yes, yeah. So this album is a mixture of Stalaglyph 1 and Stalaglyph 3 photographs, I should say. So
very sophisticated sets. So presumably they were sort of half-inching them to help with their escape.
Absolutely. So they're making both, they're making costumes and at the same time also making civilian clothing to aid those who are escaping.
Bums on Broadway, Stalaglyph 3, 1942.
Aladdin, Panto. Amazing.
But as you say, this is before the war turns.
Well, so yeah, but this is 43, look.
Somewhere in this album there is a innocuous photograph of the actor Peter Butterworth as well, right, on stage, who was a prisoner in Stalaglyph 1 and Stalaglyph 3.
Sports Day. I mean, this is a hard contrast with Far East, isn't it? This
absolutely. Is and of course, these are officers, yes, in prisoner of war camps. So well, they don't have the requirement to work in the same way that other ranks. So other ranks tend to be working probably 6 days a week, in some nominally at least non-war related work. But officers have to find things to do. And this is kind of certainly an exhibition of that within this album.
Amazing.
Play called For the Love Absolutely. Of Mike in Stalaglyph 3 with, you know, with a policeman, with a proper policeman's helmet. And
it's surreal, though. There's a surreality to it.
It definitely is.
And as you say, they have to find stuff to do. So, I mean, there is a Keep Your Mind Occupied poster there.
An arts and crafts exhibition. You know, there's some models of boats and gliders and incredible stuff.
One of my favourite examples was from a prisoner who was in one of the Malag and Milag naval camps, and they put on a dinner and show performance over a number of evenings where they got special permission from the guards to have the show as well as the three-course dinner. It was a very basic dinner, as you might expect.
But nevertheless.
But they had permission to extend their curfew, and also they had to promise that they would, when it was hosted, that no one would attempt to escape whilst they were hosting it, I think. So,
I mean, that's amazing. These are absolutely incredible. And what's, so these are the Red Cross?
Yeah, absolutely. So around here, so these, as I say, we have an enormous number of Red Cross reports for both military prisoner of war camps, I should say, and also civilian internee camps as well in mainland Europe. They are carried out, you know, these inspections take place once a month, once every couple of months within each camp, as well as, you know, so this is for Stalagate B, which is one of the bigger camps, but it has a large number of work detachments. So there are groups of prisoners who are not at the main camp, they're working off in factories or mines or wherever it might be. And so the Red Cross are also inspecting those. And you know, again, the conditions can vary for individuals. You have situations where it kind of says, well, there's no recreation space for this work detachment, or, you know, the food is quite poor, mainly because the chef in the mess isn't very good.
Right. You know, I mean, he's not, he's not happy in this. This inspection is report on Stalagate B, visited 14th September. This is from late 1944, November 1944. Mm. States, present mixture nationalities creates many inadequacies. General conditions deteriorated, camp infested with bugs and fleas. Majority British prefer sleep outside, owing vermin fumigation apparently ineffective.
Mm.
I mean, if you're sleeping outside in
November 1944, it must be pretty bad inside, wasn't it? Lazarette isolation ward subject to strong complaint by delegate. Well, that's again, that goes back to the kind of lack of straight lines, isn't it?
And again, within the reports, though they're kind of high level reports, what the inspectors are allowed to do is speak to nominated individual prisoners. So you get kind of some personal perspectives, if you like, about experiences. So it's a man of confidence, a so-called man of confidence, who can speak to the Red Cross inspector without fear of kind of repercussions for anything that they've said to the inspector. And yeah, you know, they're very, as you might expect are then quite candid about the situation. And, but again, you get lots of information about the hundreds or, you know, number of thousands of books that have been donated to these camps, or the sports equipment which have been given to prisoners, or whatever might have been requested by prisoners. You know, for a large chunk of the war, they're kind of getting it. You know, they're receiving those things.
Well, we could talk about this forever. We say this a lot on this podcast. Will, these documents are all, they're to do with this new exhibition, the Great Escapes, which starts on February the 2nd here at the National Archive.
February the 2nd, runs until the 21st of July.
And with a full sort of array of documents telling this same story. So starting with the 1929 Geneva Convention, ending with the 1949, which is, I think, quite an interesting way of bracketing things. Anyway, thanks everyone for listening. We will see you again very soon. And we'll be back at the National Archive for another episode shortly. Cheerio.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.